Welcome to the Allowed Podcast. I'm Louise Steinman, curator of the Allowed series, presented by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles. Allowed is a series of dynamic lectures, readings, performances, and discussions that take place in the Mark Taper Auditorium at the historic downtown Central Library in the heart of L.A. To learn more about Allowed and how you can support the Los Angeles Public Library, please go to our website, www.alloudla.org. The program you're about to hear from the Allowed Archives was produced in 2005. My pleasure to introduce Glenn David Gold, who will introduce today's guest. Glenn David Gold received his MFA for creative writing from the University of California, Irvine, and he's written for Playboy, McSweeney's, and the New York and Los Angeles Times Sunday magazines. Glenn is the author of the novel Carter Beats the Devil, currently translated into 13 languages, which weaves together fact and fiction and is filled with historical references, the magician Charles Carter, Philo Farnsworth, the inventor of television, and one of the true mysteries of the 1920s, the death of President Warren G. Harding, who was basically fine one day and gone the next. Carter Beats the Devil is wildly ambitious in scope, weaving the world of vaudeville magicians into the big picture early 20th century history, exploring complex interrelationships among magic, science, and faith. The way that Glenn subjects the past to the same wondrous transformations as the rabbit in a skilled illusionist's hat predisposed him, in my mind, to be the right interviewer for Umberto Eco. But I also have to thank Glenn in advance for his courage, because no one else whom I asked to do an onstage conversation with Umberto Eco was brave or foolhardy enough to say yes. Though he did ask me via email if there were any arcane requirements by Mr. Eco that he should know about. For instance, if there were M&Ms on stage, should he pluck out all the orange ones? Well, I predict that both Glenn and Umberto Eco are going to have a lot of fun, and I predict that we all will too. So to introduce today's honored guest, please welcome novelist Glenn David Gold.
I never realized how fascinating I am. Wow. Or that you'd asked other people to do this. In a recent interview with the London Telegraph, Umberto Eco said, "I always fear to be wrong. Those who are always certain of their own work risk being idiots. Insecurity is a great force, apropos of teaching. The moment I start a new class, I feel panic. If you don't feel panic, you cannot succeed." And for preparing for today, I have felt both panic and idiocy, and now I know I'm on the right track. So let's talk about a wicked consumption-based literature that appeals not to the writers, but to the readers' insecurity. Architectural Digest, for instance, they feature houses we could never afford. We could also never afford to travel in the circles of those butterflies profiled in Vanity Fair. Now, lately, young novelists have caught that particular bug. How often have you read a review that says, this 900-page book is 200 pages too long, the digressions are painful, he's obviously never met a woman, but you should buy this book anyway because he's so goddamn smart. This is the literature of insecurity, the promise that you are in the presence of someone more brilliant than you are, and in the noble service of his ego, you should sacrifice all hope of getting a good read. We're starting a movement, baby. Now, the difference between Umberto Eco and many other academes is he doesn't buy into that crap. He finds pleasure in knowledge, and he doesn't use a reader's insecurity as a fulcrum, and we're left with a spirit of true intellectual joy, which makes a fine literary companion. No other writer I can think of has so happily explored the erotic menage a trois among writer, reader, and the bed they lie upon, whether that would be the printed page, fax, spam, comic book, whatever. In 1942, when he was 10 years old, Eco entered a competition for young Italian fascists, that would be all young Italians, on the topic, should we die for the glory of Mussolini and the immortal destiny of Italy? He argued yes, and won. And this started him on a roll. He pioneered the field of semiotics, the study of signs and signifiers, and he has used his prodigious intelligence to examine the meaning of everything from the Tower of Babel and Dante's relationship with Adam to why it is so hard to renew your driver's license. In just the last couple of months, for instance, this gentleman has published the novel we're here to talk about today. He's also published in the anthology on the history of beauty, a new assembly of writings on literature. He has continued his several newspaper columns, written an introduction to Will Eisner's graphic novel, The Plot, about the protocols of the Elders of Zion. A professor at the University of Bologna, has lectured at Yale, NYU, Columbia, Cambridge, Harvard, was an influential member of the proto-snarky Grupo 63 Conclave of Literary Critics, has 33 honorary degrees and further commendations, such as the UCLA Medal, which he received yesterday, which might be his most recent, unless he managed to slip out of his hotel last night to score something further without his hosts noticing. Echo has published about 30 books on philosophy, morality, linguistics, politics, popular culture, and aesthetics. I'm sorry this is taking so long, but you've done an awful lot of stuff. His novel, The Name of the Rose, has sold something like 10 million copies, was the basis of a vastly popular film starring Sean Connery. Echo maintains voluminous correspondences with painters, architects, and politicians, coined a popular metaphor comparing the religious orientations of Apple and window operating systems. He plays the recorder, is a world-renowned expert on both James Joyce and James Bond, and scored the winning goal in the 1982 World Cup semifinals, beating Argentina 2-1. But it's for his novels that he is best known. Echo writes mysteries, philosophical page-turners. Yet it is alleged alternately that they are elaborate practical jokes or that many people buy them without reading them. To those misguided souls, I say you are missing out. Who can forget In the Name of the Rose when the American president and the Soviet premier are handcuffed together and must fight their way through the sewers of Paris to an uncertain freedom? Or Bodolino, when the Colombian drug lord, coked to the gills, must make one last choice between family and business with tragic consequences? Or semiotics and the philosophy of language, when the American president and the Soviet premier are handcuffed together and must fight their way through the sewers of Paris to an uncertain freedom. Okay, I might have gotten a detail or two wrong there, but then again, I'm no Giambattista Bodoni. In The Mysterious Flame of Queen Loana, Mr. Echo's current book, Giambattista Bodoni awakes from an incident that has left him without semantic memory, scholastic memory. With semantic memory, but without episodic or emotional memory. The result is that he cannot remember his wife, his children, or his feelings for them, but he can recite verbatim every book he has ever read. I'm especially fond of his use of language to paper over his memory loss, attempting to determine through the use of the French tu and vu forms whether he's having an affair with the woman he's into. He retreats to his family house in Solara and begins a journey through his childhood books and records. And as he reproduces sentences and paragraphs from old books and songs, it results in many pages of a stream of someone else's consciousness. This could have been for the reader simply a catalog of what Umberto Eco has read, but instead it's charming, funny, and intriguing. Bodoni seems to dissolve from the I who began the book into more of a we of the whole generation of Italians shaped as children by the fascist government. Furthermore, it's illustrated by texts, and I have to tell you, this is one of the most beautiful books I've ever seen. If you go through it, it's just page after page of really beautiful illustrations and everything else. There's comic books, juvenile literature, and they all serve as exhibits introduced into the Court of Identity. And then, at the end, not to give too much away, Bodoni is joined by a mysterious stimulator who might well be God or Echo or the ideal reader or his first love or perhaps some much darker and apocalyptic force. It's experimental, it's difficult, it's inviting, and it's entertaining in the best possible sense. It will be a pleasure to be heard read aloud. So please join me in welcoming writer, reader, stimulator, and perpetually the most secure man in the room, Professor Umberto Eco.
I was supposed to come here and to tell you something about my book in order to justify the few pages I'll read, but Glenn did all the job, so it's a sort of dangerous game. As Glenn said, my character loses his personal autobiographical memory. That's is clinically possible to lose one memory and not the other one. And he comes back in the second part. But the first part is devoted to describe what can happen to a person who has lost his autobiographical memory. And even though I controlled on clinical cases and on the specialized literature, I was also encouraged to invent some situations that are very similar, and I hope that in the next future we'll enter in the clinical literature on the subject. For instance, he goes back to his studio of rare books dealer, and he sees there his beautiful young assistant, and he feels some emotion, and he wonders if he had a love affair with her. But you cannot ask if you are a gentleman, especially. And since she knows that he has lost his memory, he obviously, even though there was something, she cannot speak of that. This is a strange situation. Next time you lose your memory, you can find in my book some instructions about how to cope with that situation. In the second part, he enters the attic of his grandfather's country house, and he starts this reconstruction not of its own memory, because he's unable to recognize the object. He is not Proust. He's not Proust. He cannot remember his own Madeleine. He has to deal with a sort of a public mineral memory. And in this way, it builds up and retrieves the memory of a generation. So I will write you some pages from the entering in the attic, because somebody has found, and that's true, I was not thinking of that in writing the novel, but I wrote something about that before. This attic is what in the Baroque era was a theater of memory, big ideal constructions that help people to keep track of a lot of notions. So it's a sort of living theater in which Wunderkammer and Jurassic Technology Museum of the 30s and the 40s in Italy. As far as I knew, I had never seen the inside of an attic, nor of a cellar for that matter, but everyone knows what cellars are like. Subterranean, dark, damp, always cool, and you have to bring a candle or a torch. The Gothic romance is rich in the subterranean, the monk Ambrosio wandering gloomily among creeps, nature underground passageways like Tom Sawyer's caverns, the mystery of darkness. All houses have cellars, but not all have attics, especially in cities where they have penthouses. But is there really no literature of attics? And in that case, what is 8 days in an attic? The title came to mind, but nothing else. Even if you do not go through them all at once, you can tell that attics of the Solara house extend over all three wings. You enter an area that stretches from the facade to the rear of the building, but then narrow passages open and bulkheads appear, wooden partitions that divide the spaces, roofs defined by metal shelving units or old chest of drawers, the interchanges of an endless labyrinth. Having ventured down one of the corridors on the left, I turned once or twice more and found myself back in front of the entrance. Immediate sensations, heat, above all, which is nature just beneath the roof. Then light. It comes in part from a series of dormer windows, which can be seen when you look at the front of the house, but which on the inside are largely obstructed by piles of junk, so that in some cases the sunlight barely filters through, reduced to yellow blaze, ester with an infinity of particles, revealing that the penumbra must also be crazed with a multitude of moths, spore, primordial atoms caught up in their Brownian skirmishes, primal bodies warming in the void. Who spoke of those? Lucretius? Sometimes those slants of light ricocheted off the glass panes of a dismantled buffet or a full-length mirror that from another angle had looked like merely another dull surface propped against the wall, and then the occasional skylight, darkened by decades of encrusted pluvial detritus, but still able to make a pale zone of illumination on the floor. Finally, the color, the attic's dominant color, imparted by the roof beams, by the crates piled here and there, by the remains of wobbly chests of drawers, is the color of carpentry, composed of many shades of brown, from the yellowish brown of unfinished wood to the warmth of the maple, to the darker tones of old dressers, their finishes flaking off, to the ivory of old papers overflowing their boxes. If a cellar prefigures the underworld, an attic promises a rather threadbare paradise where the dead bodies appear in a pulverulent glow, a vegetal elixir that, in the absence of green, makes you feel you are in a parched tropical forest, an artificial canebrake where you are immersed in a tepid sauna. I began rummaging through several shelves at the risk of toppling the stacks of containers that had accumulated there. My grandfather apparently had also collected containers, especially colorful metal ones, illustrated tins of warmer biscotti showing cherubic children on swings, an Arnaldi cachet box, the Cordinava pomade tin with the golden borders and the plant motifs, a box of assorted Perry nibs, a sumptuous shiny coffer of presbytero pencils, all still perfectly aligned and untouched like a scholar's ammo belt, and finally a can of Talmone cocoa featuring an old woman tenderly offering that easily digested beverage to a smiling old man, ancien régime, still wearing breeches. I couldn't help identifying the elderly couple with my grandfather, and that grandmother I must have barely known. Next, I came across a tin, late 19th century in style, of effervescente brioschi. A couple of cheerful gentlemen are tasting flutes of table water proffered by a charming waitress. My hands, remember first, you take an envelope containing a soft white powder, you pour it slowly into the neck of the bottle after it has been filled with tap water, and you swirl it around a little to make sure no powder sticks to the neck. Then you take another envelope, which contains a grainy powder made of tiny crystals, and you pour that in too, and quickly, because the waters begin to seethe immediately and you have to hurry to get the cap on, and then wait for the chemical miracle to take place in that primordial soup as the liquid gurgles and tries to bubble out around the rubber gasket. Finally, the tempest subsides and the sparkling water is ready to drink. Table water, children's wine, homemade mineral water. I said to myself, Vichy water. But besides my hands, something else had been set in motion, almost as it had been that day in front of Clarabella's treasure. I looked for another container, this one not a tin but a small carton, definitely from a later period, one which I had opened on countless occasions before we sat down to our meals. Its illustration would have been slightly different. Still the same gentleman, who still were drinking the amazing water from champagne glasses, except that clearly visible on the table before them was a cartoon, identical to the actual cartoon. And on that second one were depicted the same gentleman drinking in front of a table on which appeared yet another cartoon of powder, that one also with gentlemen who, and so on forever. You knew that all you needed was a magnifying glass or a high-powered microscope to see other cartons within cartons and a beam like Chinese boxes or matryoshka dolls. infinity, as seen through the eyes of a boy who has yet to study Zeno's paradox. The race toward an unreachable goal. Neither the tortoise nor Achilles would ever have reached the last cartoon, the last gentleman, the last waitress. We learn as children the metaphysics of the infinite and the infinitesimal calculus, though we are unaware of what we are learning, and it might be the image of an endless regress or its opposite, the dreadful promise of the eternal return and of the turning of the ages that bite their own tails, because upon reaching the final cartoon, were there such a thing, we might have discovered at the bottom of that vortex ourselves, holding the first cartoon in our hands. Why had I decided to become an antiquarian book dealer if not in order to have a fixed point the day that Gutenberg printed the first Bible in Mainz to go back to? At least you know that nothing existed before that. Or rather, other things had existed, but you know that you can't stop there. Otherwise, you would be not a book dealer, but a decipherer of manuscripts. One chooses a profession that involves only 5.5 centuries because as a child, one daydreamed about the infinitude of Vichy water tins. Well, then there's the third part, because my character loses his memory because of a stroke. At the end of the second part, when he has more or less reconstructed his generational memory, he has a second stroke. And the third part is in a coma. Outside, I believe, is in a flat situation, but he thinks in some way, and he retrieves all his childhood memories, including the memory of his first love, which, however, he cannot find again the face. So I cannot tell you what happens in this second part. I can only assure you that the murderer is not the butler. But at the end, excited as it is in this sort of suspended life, he's not sure he's already dead or he's dreaming. He asks the Queen Loana, who is a character of an old comic book that in America was Tim Tyler's Luck. And he has a sort of what he calls a benevolent apocalypse, because in face of the staircase of his high school, and the staircase recurs in at least 10 images, and it is the staircase of The American in Paris by Vincente Minnelli, where Georges Guettari sings Stairways to Paradise. And from that staircase, step down, tap dancing, all the characters of the literature and comics of his childhood, his own parents, San Giovanni Bosco, tap dancing with his priest and long suit. And he has this sort of vision of which I read only a few parts, and as I have been requested of, in Italian, also because it's more important here, the rhythm than the content. You can imagine your own apocalypse. E ai piedi della scalinata appare ora Mandrake, the magician, che fa volteggiare la sua canna con disinvoltura. Sale salutando col cilindro levato, mentre ogni passo la base dello scalino si illumina e canta I build a stairway to paradise. E Mandrake punta ora il bastone verso l'alto per annunciare la discesa della Dragon Lady, inguainata di seta nera. E a ogni scalino gli studenti si inginocchiano e tendono la paglietta in atto di adorazione mentre lei canta con voce di sassofono in calore sentimental questa notte infinita, questo cielo autunnale. Dietro lei scendono, finalmente ritornati sul nostro pianeta, Flash Gordon, Dale Arden, Dol Zarkov, intonando Blue Sky, Smiling at Me, Blue Birds. E li segue George Formby con il suo ukulele, strimpellando con sorriso cavallino, it's in the air, this funny feeling everywhere, eccetera.
Calano i sette nani recitando ritmicamente il nome dei sette re di Roma, meno uno, e poi Topolino e Minni sotto braccio Orazio e Clarabella, onusta dei diademi del suo tesoro, al ritmo di Pippo Pippo, non lo sa, ai jump over, poi a un cenno dello psicopompo appare Sandokan. È vestito di una tunica di seta indiana, fermata alla vita da una sciarpa cremisi adorna di pietre preziose, il turbante fissato da un diadema grande come una nocciola, dalla cinta gli spuntano i calci di due pistole di squisita fattura e una scimitarra dal fodero tempestato di rubini. Baritoneggia mai lui sotto il cielo di Singapore in un manto di stelle d'oro ed ecco ora Cyrano de Bergerac, la spada sguainata, che con voce baritonalmente nasale, con ampio gesto interroga la folla: conosci mia cugina, che tipo originale. E dietro di lui viene morbida Josephine Baker, ma questa volta a poil, come le calmucche di razze popoli della terra, san vongonellino di banane alla vita, e accenna morbidamente: oh, 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 quel provo tormento e dolore al pensar che vi offesi, oh signor. E mentre i quattro moschettieri accennano in falsetto: she gets too hungry for dinner at eight, she likes to dinner, and that's why milady's a tramp. Scende Edmond Dantes canterellando questa volta: amico mio, pago io, pago io. E l'abate Faria, che lo segue avvolto nel suo sudario di tela di sacco, lo addita e dice: è lui, sì sì, è proprio lui. Mentre Jim, il dottor Livesey, Lord Trelawney, il capitano Long Smollett e Long John Silver, travestito da Pietro Gamba di Legno, che ogni gradino batte un colpo di piede e tre di protesi, gli contestano i diritti sul tesoro del pirata Flint. Ben Gunn, con sorriso di grillo, Griffy dice tra i suoi denti canini: cheese. Con clangore di stivali teutonici scende il camerata Richard, facendo risuonare le sue clacchette al ritmo di New York, New York is a wonderful town, eccetera eccetera. E lungo la scala si stende ora, per miracolo scenico ordito dal dottor Zarkov, una lunga monorotaia scintillante, lungo la quale arriva la filotea, giunge al sommo, penetra nell'atrio del liceo e, come da un allegro alveare, le discendono, ripercorrendo la scala verso il basso, il nonno, la mamma, il papà che tiene Alda piccolissima per mano, il dottor Osimo, il signor Piazza, don Cognasso, il parroco di San Martino e Granula, con il collo fasciato da un'armatura che gli sostiene persino la nuca, come Eric von Stroheim, raddrizzandogli quasi le spalle, e tutti mordunano la famiglia canterina dalla sera alla mattina. E mentre su tutti plana Meo con le sue grandi orecchie al vento, superbamente asinino, irrompono in schiera disordinata tutti i ragazzi dell'oratorio, ma in uniforme della pattuglia dell'avorio, spingendo avanti Fang, la flessuosa pantera nera, e salmodiando esotici vanno le carovane del Tigrai. Poi, dopo alcuni crack crack su rinoceronti di passaggio, levano le armi, i cappelli, per salutare lei, la regina Loana.
Never before so looked forward to the apocalypse. That's quite wonderful. Thank you very much for doing that. I much like that. Yes. I've had some notes here to ask you about, but just your performance right there made me curious about something. You're obviously a wonderful reader, and you've been a lecturer for a number of years, but I noticed that most of the writing, at least the writing that I know about, is for the page, for the printed page. Have you ever been tempted to write opera, to write plays?
I did it in my youth. Student musicals. Then I stopped.
And you stopped because?
Because you have to choose in your life. As I tell in the novel, as everybody at the age of 16, I wrote also poems. But then I stopped because, as I say, the world is divided into 50-50. There are those who write poems, the good poets write poems, and then they stop and they burn their poems out. The bad poets continue to publish until the Nobel Prize.
Right. And I guess as a follow-up, I asked this somewhat embarrassing question because we're in a company town, but Tom Stoppard, for instance, he did uncredited rewrites on the new Star Wars movie. You've never gotten that call, and Adam Sandler has never called and said, I'm not going to do a movie unless Umberto Eco does my character. That hasn't happened?
No, I only repent of a fact. After there was the movie from the name of the Rose, I detected that great part of the readers read the book after the movie, and that is very embarrassing for an author, because it's another person who suggests the reader how to see, I realized that the ideal situation was the one of Homer, who had the movie made 2,000 years after after the book. And so, in order to wait for the next millennia, I told my publisher not to give the rights for a movie from my other day. But then I realized that the producer said that he wanted to give the movie to Stanley Kubrick. And then he died. Okay. And so I have lost this. Probably it would have been a great, for the Foucault's Pendulum. It was really probably in tune with the way of thinking and seeing of Kubrick. So that's...
Yes. It's interesting.
I would have collaborated in some way.
Yeah. I'm not sure how many people have picked up the book yet, but it really is profusely illustrated, and it's an interesting choice. Before in previous works of yours, I've seen diagrams. I've seen you'll have occasional reproductions of things. Talk about the choice of actually including, I guess, this evidence in here about the personality.
You know, first of all the novels until the 40s were illustrated. All the books I read in my youth from the 19th century or the early 20th century were illustrated books. Then the novel have been no more illustrated because we have movies, TV, and many other sources of image. But if you took even the 18th century first novels, they were illustrated. Second, it's a book on nostalgia, and I wanted to use it to make evident to the eyes of my readers all those memorabilia they made part of. Third, and then it was fun. It was funny to look for them. I had the 60% already in my shelves, but I had to make also a 2-3 years research in flea markets and internet, never discovering something because I have a good memory. Always recognizing something that I had already here in my head, and I never discovered something that I had forgot. And the last reason, since I speak also of the kind of education we received about racism, war, heroism, I was afraid that some younger reader could say, but you invented that. No, that's true.
Right.
It happened. It really happened. So it has also what a French semiologist called effet de véridiction, to make something true, to prove that it's true. But mostly it was the great fun of working with all that material that I repeat, I had in great part already at home, not before I saved everything from my childhood, because a lot of things got lost. See, I saved 10%. But because I spent the rest of my adult life without thinking to that book in retrieving it. Every time I could, I reconstructed my library, my school books of the primary school and so on, because I think that the main job of an adult life is remembering childhood. And all the rest is literature, as Verlaine could have said.
Is there, at the moment, there's, a revival of interest in graphic novels in America. For instance, Will Eisner, who you wrote the introduction for and things. But there's also at the same time kind of a continuous debate about what they would call high versus low culture here. And I was interested in your use of imagery here. I had a feeling that wasn't as much of a problem for you, that almost everything in a way is kind of equal if it all influences you and all brings back childhood and all has associations. Doesn't matter if it's a comic book or if it's a fascist anthem.
Certainly. But I want to be, when you mention Willie Eisner, and I could mention, I don't know, Art Spiegelman, is not low culture. That's great narrative of our time. The fact that it is illustrated, and also illustrated, doesn't make any difference. But obviously, I used even trash material, because not all the comic books of my childhood were works of art. Little Nemo was, but Mandrake was not so much. Gordon, yes, because Alex Raymond was a great artist, but Mandrake of the Phantom were, if you look at them now, very poor artistic products. But I had in mind a paper written once by Proust, Éloge de la mauvaise musique, an appraisal of the bad music, in which, ironically, he called bad music the radio music, and saying that it was not so bad at all, because our memory, our soul is shaped not only by great literature, great music, but also by that, and we are formed by both. So they have to be taken with great respect.
Right.
Yes, we are both. If we were only Shakespeare and Beethoven, we would be complete idiots. Happily, we are Beethoven and Gershwin and Shakespeare and Flash Gordon.
Right, right. Now, what's interesting is, as you lead us through the novel, there are some what I would call perhaps more innocent childhood memories of Mickey Mouse, and then it becomes a little more complicated as the fascism comes and takes over and starts to take over the actual meaning of what it is that you're seeing. Could you talk to us a little bit, perhaps? My favorite anecdote that's in here is about the redesignation of I believe it's Buffalo Bill.
Yes. Yeah. No. There are things that I realized definitely only in reading the book, in writing the book. For instance, what I call a schizophrenic education, because in the same year, in the same moment, we received from the school the heroic anthems, glory, that how is beautiful to die, and on the other side, we watched the Fred Astaire movies or the American comic books, who had an enormous ideological impact. I always remember that I discovered the existence of such an idea as the freedom of press by reading Mickey Mouse Journalist. Because obviously, living under a dictatorship, you don't know as a child that what does it mean, a free press. Then there were certain products that probably didn't have an ideological impact here. They were mere amusement, but read in another situation, in a sort of Jorge Luis Borges reinvestment of the perspective. Flash Gordon was somebody who fought against a tyrant. So we learned that there are tyrants against whom. The fascism didn't completely realize the ideological impact of that stuff, but they tried to Italianize it. And the more the war, the Second World War, went on, for instance, there were the weekly magazines of Buffalo Bill, and I have a copy at home, suddenly, the subtitle was the hero of the Far West hero, and it became the Italian Far West hero. And there was a note on the second page saying that it was discovered that Buffalo Bill was in fact of Italian origins, and his name was Trombetti. And as after the declaration of war to the United States, because everybody thinks that at a certain point, scandalized by Hitler, the United States went in war. No, it was Mussolini who declared war to the United States. You understand? No?
Having read
thinking
the book,
that he could have sent a little group of young fascists to invade New York. That's marvelous. He declared war to the United States, not the opposite.
At that time, even Mickey Mouse, who had survived until the end, because it seems that Mussolini liked him. There was, every week, it was a weekly magazine entitled Topolino. Topolino is an Italian Mickey Mouse. It was devoted to Disney stories plus other story. And the main cover story was Mickey Mouse, agent of publicity. And that's the story. And suddenly, the new week, his name was no more Topolino, but Tufolino. He was no more a mouse, but a sort of gnome of a human-like small animal. His fiancée was equally mini, but she was not a mouse. But and all the characters, all the names were the same, but the doors was the artist was another, and the name had changed. And it looked so normal at the time.
Right. Yes, well, actually, it's fun. I just was reminded in Five Moral Pieces, I think it is, you have an essay about recognizing the signs of fascism coming, and I don't remember the point in which it's renaming the mice as sort of a symptom of fascism, but now that's something that could go right in there, definitely. I had some questions about your narrator of this specific book, because it's an interesting choice to have a rare book dealer as your mouthpiece, I suppose. And I guess more specifically, I was thinking about this, about book collecting and book dealing versus being the person who actually writes the books. It's an interesting way of pushing away some of the things that would be natural to you, and at the same time, maybe getting some ideas in under the door.
Now, the main problem was that since I was trying to make a generational biography and not a personal biography, I changed the age. It is 10 years younger than me. That's why I was obliged to set the story in 1980 and not in 1990 at the time of the first Gulf War. Why? Because he had to be 60 at the time. I made him as a book dealer because I had to choose a job for him. And I could have made of him a nuclear physicist, but I didn't know what they do. And being a books collector, I know the jobs of that. And then probably I paid a debt of gratitude for the birth of this book. The story is the following. Initially, 5 years ago, I wanted to write a personal autobiography in the form of an essay, an illustrated essay. But in these days, Alberto Sorosa, a distinguished Italian literary critic of my own same age, wrote his own autobiography and invited me to present the book. And I said, I hate this book and I hate you because you have stopped me, that I cannot do the same thing, even though he spent his youth in Rome, and so he didn't see the partisan war while I was in northwestern Italy, so the situation was different. But well, it stinked as a case of plagiarism. And so I say, okay, I don't do that. Okay. But I have a great virtue that makes that I am a great thinker because of that virtue. I never listen to people when they are talking to me. I start musing, thinking to something different. So I was sitting in a bar with a martini and with a friend of mine who is a rare book dealer, and he started talking. And he used a word, I don't know why, which maybe said memory or maybe said I forgot that. And suddenly I had the idea, oh, no, it has to be a novel on a man who loses his memory and then he retrieves. At a certain point, my friend said, but you are not listening to me. No, he said, I am writing a new novel. He was so happy to act as my muse that he paid me a second martini. And so probably I made of Yambo a book dealer in order to because I was grateful to my friend.
Okay, that was a better story than my theory. I had read, it's in the postscript to Name of the Rose, you had, I think you were quoting generally both Eliot and Joyce, who said that art is an escape from personal emotion. And I thought that might go hand in hand with the idea of...
No, that's... No? It was Eliot, poetry.
Oh, Eliot, okay.
Poetry is not the expression of emotion, but the escape from emotion, yes.
And
you have to wait not to be still in love in order to write a love story. If not, it's a personal letter.
Which makes it makes perfect sense, and because you don't do it in the heat of the moment. And I thought, in a way, that with book collecting and book dealing, there's the kind of the psychoanalytic theory of it, which is that you invest books with emotion because books will never fail you the way people do. And things won't fail you the way people do. And as a way, here's a person who can kind of trade and hand out emotions without them actually personally affecting him. But I like your story better. Okay.
In fact, yes. That's why I didn't write an autobiography, because following the Eliot maxim, one should write his own autobiography only after his death. That would be the good balcony from which to see the rest of your life. If you are inside, you have all the wrong parallaxes.
And yet there are, for instance, going out on a limb here, I'm not 100% sure, but I think that those compositions you put in that are of Yambo's are of yours, The Unbreakable Glass,
the paper you quoted on Mussolini, the following one on The Unbreakable Glass, yes, were mine. And it was just in writing the book that I discovered that they were written at the distance of 9 months. And the first one was a fascist paper. The second one was already the paper of somebody who had understood what life, and 9 months were enough to change radically the way of thinking of a boy. That was interesting.
Yeah.
It was there. I discovered it. I had this in some shelf, abandoned.
Yeah, it's interesting because the amount of disillusionment that comes into his voice in just those 9 months. You have to read the book to find out exactly what it means.
But the motto is not about it.
Yes, but the books are available in the lobby afterwards. You have to purchase them then. One of the things I noticed is late in the book, there's a lot of the change from the I to we. A lot of the narration happens. You'd seen in interviews with you, you were talking about it being the voice more of a generation than a person, and it very seamlessly slips into that. And yet there's moments later when Yambo refers to Sherlock Holmes's adventures and Treasure Island as my stories. And I was wondering, I'd read in an interview with Yale Doctorow where he talked about when he was a kid, he used to pretend he'd actually written the books he'd read. Like, you know, Captain Blood, that was one of my good ones. Was that an experience you had at all when reading books?
No, but immediately as I read the book, I wanted to do the same. There is an essay in my collection on literature, because once I was asked by a lady, a friend, who was putting together a series of essays, how do I write? And I told the story of how I was a great, until the age of 10 or 12, I was a great author of unfinished novels. Because I started the novel, a school book, but since then, as an adult, I worked in a publishing house, so I had already the sense of the book as physical object, not only the content, but also, in fact, I learned how to bind the book, even though very clumsily. But and so I wanted the book to be printed. So I made the first page with the name of the publisher. It was an invented name. And I started writing it in capital letters, which is very, very tiring. And first I made all the illustrations. And the illustration gave me the idea of what the story could have been. It's curious that it happened to me with the novel I wrote as an adult. First I draw situations, and only after the story comes. Then I started writing the first chapter, but at the end of the second one, I surrendered. Then I read new books, and I wanted to tell a different story. So I made a lot of unfinished masterpieces.
Until the age of 12 or so.
Yes.
Well, I forgive you. That's okay. That's all right. It is interesting. In the future, we are going to have generations, if there is some young Yambo out there right now, who will have books, but will also have a lot more ephemeral sorts of memories and won't quite be able to track them down on the net. Things like
I
that.
Don't believe it.
Okay.
I visit today the children's section of this library. There is a generation growing up through, within, among books, more than my and your generation. I have a grandchild who is 5 at August, who has an enormous library. He knows, he doesn't read them, but he knows the title, and so he said, please tell me the story of. So then he watches TV and all the other instruments, but if educated in the right family, he is growing up with a respect, love, and interest for books. At my age, he will not have the same kind of memories, even though I am piling up in the attic of my real country house all the memorabilia he has to find when it will be on his tens. I am on the verge of throwing away many copies of Playboy because I don't want he finds them at the age of 10. So probably he will have a mixed memory of his own books and of, as it happened to me, because I found in the cell, my grandfather was a typographer. Mm-hmm. So, and when retired, he bound books. And when he died, probably a lot of people who gave him books, popular books to bind them, didn't ask them back. And so I found once in the cellar at home a box, enormous box like this, full of books of the late 19th century and early 20th that I read and I read, and they have disappeared because they have been used so many times that I destroyed them. So it's possible to have a three layers memory, the one of your childhood, the one of the childhood of your parents, and maybe the one of the childhood of your grandparents.
So it's almost like the two guys on the box with the Vichy water, like
English, yes, with like the Vichy water. Yes. Yes,
there. Are we? How are we doing on time? We
have one more question, Glenn, and then we can have a few
audience. Okay. Let me just ask you this, just as one last question here. As it's interesting, when I was going on the net and looking at a lot of awards and ceremonies and degrees you've been to, it's an incredible amount of accomplishment, but I do find that most writers learn more from failure and from the things that didn't quite work out. Do you have anything in your mind that you feel like where you look at and you feel like it was an educational experience from something that didn't quite work out from before?
You speak of my life as a novelist or my life as a scholar?
Your choice.
But, you know, obviously every novelist or poet would be read by billions of people, obviously. So when you say that The Name of the Rose made 10 million copies, somebody says 15, but who knows, because no, because there was not yet the international law for rights, so many Eastern countries published in a pirate way, so we couldn't control. We are in this planet 6 billions. So 10 million is a 0.00000%. So as a writer, I am a complete failure.
Failure, I think.
But you cannot make this kind of a... While as a scholar, you can always be troubled by the fact that you wrote this essay thinking to it. A particular target. Now, I want to discuss with, let's say, analytic philosophers or hermeneutics, and maybe your target didn't pay attention to your book, and so you find always some certain bitterness. But it is the insatisfaction you mentioned at the insecurity you
exactly.
mentioned at the beginning. Yes.
Yes, right, and it is something you go from. Do you go back and reread your work after it's published or not?
It depends. It depends. Well, for the novels, I am obliged, first of all, to reread it at least a lot of times for discussing with translators and so on and so forth. Then sometimes, if I read a quotation, I return to with the scholarly work. It depends on what you have to talk of in the next seminar. Sometime you go back to control.
Okay. Well, thank you. Okay. So we're yes. We'll turn it over to the audience. Okay. Good. So we're going to take questions from the audience, and there is a microphone here that people can come up and approach. No, she will bring the microphone to you. She will throw the microphone at you. If somebody has a question for Senor Eco, man in the red shirt back here.
Okay. Thank you, Dr. Eco, for coming here and speaking. I've actually been waiting for years to actually see you live and to get a book signed. I fell in love with your writing when I was 17 years old and have read pretty much all of your novels since then. And I wonder what you see as your job as a storyteller from this day forward. I mean, those of us who have read your work have a fairly good sense of you as a storyteller to this day. But what is your job as a storyteller going forward?
I think to have been always a storyteller. I think that my essays have a narrative structure. They have only the structure of a whodunit. I was reproached when presenting my doctoral dissertation to have showed publicly all the steps of my research, of my trial and error research, also the hypothesis that I rejected. Mm-hmm. The professor who reproached me then published my dissertation as a book in his series, so I accepted his criticism. I recognized that I was doing in my dissertation exactly that, and I was discovering that that was what one has to do. And so my professor was wrong. Every research must be the staging of the research itself. You don't have to provide only the conclusions, but all the trial and error process. So I think to have always narrated stories. And so I don't feel such a chasm, such a difference between my two activities. Also because I share the opinion of many scholars that the whole of our knowledge takes usually the form of a narrative. Mm-hmm. If a child asks his mother, what are trees, or why, the mother doesn't answer by a technical definition. She tells a story. You take a seed, you put the seed inside, and so on, and so forth. And even a lot of the scientific or philosophical knowledge, if you analyze it properly with the eyes of a semiotician, you recognize it that it has a narrative structure. Mm-hmm. So I don't know if it was that the question. In any case, this is the answer.
Yeah. That's good.
Well, my question is somewhat related to that. In general, we see a relationship between memory and collective social consciousness. And I was wondering if you see a relationship between this attempt to reconstruct an individual memory and the loss of a case of individual amnesia by recollecting a generational social consciousness, and the very condition of amnesia, whether the memories are the cause of the amnesia.
So individual and collective amnesia?
There are two questions. One, I believe that memory is our soul. There is no other definition of a soul if not in terms of a memory, even though you are a believer. If you go to the hell without memory, why to be there? It's completely useless to suffer so much for something that you have forgot. And the same holds for paradise. So memory is your soul. And memory is made up with the autobiographical and the semantic too. I mean, at the end of my life, I would have lived a little more than a poor illiterate person, because it makes part of my soul also the Battle of Waterloo, the assassination of Julius Caesar, the trips, the travels of Ulysses. So our soul is made up with the two kinds of memories. But I didn't get exactly the second part of the question. If you are asking if the loss of memory in my character was produced by his public cultural memory?
By the very memories that he was trying to reconstruct, whether the memories are the cause of his amnesia, whether this is a process of memories of a consumption, a very ephemeral memories that lead to this condition of amnesia.
Well, you know, I don't like to comment marginally a novel providing the right meaning, because I always say that if it was so easy, instead of writing 400 pages, I would have sent a telegram. But there is a very ambiguous situation in my story. It's not so simple as we told it. It's not one who loses his memory, because his wife tells him that even in his adult life, he had a sort of blockage. He didn't want to remember aspects of his childhood. So at the age of 60, he loses his memory, but he had a problem even before. And in the third part, he discovers that this sort of psychoanalytic situation was created by a tragic experience he had as a child. So I played on those on all those aspects without trying to make out a theory of this, but to create a living situation.
Okay.
Professor Eco, you make an eloquent case for the fact that we must maintain a memory of our popular culture and of our intellectual culture, and that they must speak to one another. Do you also think, however, that it is important, even though, as in an answer to your previous question, you suggest that they share a structure, do you think that in a healthy society, one must keep also an awareness of the distinction between popular and higher culture?
Between?
Between popular culture, between Flash Gordon,
yes,
and between Dante.
Yes. I think yes, but we have to pay attention not to mix up a discourse on values and a discourse on memory and nostalgia. In my book, you can see that since they were part of my childhood, even the fascist anthems are part of my memory. And I find them so tender. Then if I make a critical discourse, I can analyze and condemn the ideology of those texts. So we have to distinguish, you know? Yes, our personal memory is made up by everything we have absorbed. I feel nostalgia for the nights of the bombing in which we were in the shelter. Can somebody feel nostalgia for such a terrible situation? Yes, since I lived it in my childhood, I feel nostalgic. Was it a good situation? Should I desire a similar situation for my grandson? Certainly not. You see, so it's a very ambiguous discourse. It depends if you are pronouncing, let's say, philosophical, critical judgment, or speaking about yourself. And if you have been a criminal, probably you think tenderly to the first crime you committed.
So we have one more question coming here, right?
Hi. If you could share your thoughts on visiting Los Angeles over here, visiting Los Angeles of the 21st century and how Los Angeles informs your thoughts on memory and culture.
You have 30 seconds.
I made a speech yesterday in a dinner saying that Los Angeles was fundamental for the story of my beard. Because I grew up my beard the first time practically in the trip from New York to Los Angeles, 69. And I cut my beard 20 years later in Los Angeles. For the rest, you know, every city one has visited has provoked some emotions and given some. But don't forget that Los Angeles is the city of Mickey Mouse.
That's right. Thank you. Thank you. Umberto Eco, thank you very much.
Aloud Audio is produced by the Library Foundation of Los Angeles and made possible through support provided by the Ralph M. Parsons Foundation, Righteous Persons Foundation, City National Bank, K&L Gates, KPMG, the Bujakji Foundation, Susan and David Rosenblum, Wallace Foundation, and Donna and Martin J. Wolf. Media support provided by KPCC 83.9 FM, KUSC 91.5 FM, and public television station KCET. Additional support provided by the Council of the Library Foundation and individual Library Foundation members. A loud theme composed by Larry Karish.